Hi, Agnes here. You're listening to Two Queers, Five Books, a podcast that has sprouted from the soil of another podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions. Ezra and I are moving through the annual cycle of Torah readings week by week, taking turns with each parsha, wrestling with the text, dancing with it, flirting with it, arguing. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy.
Vayechi. I am a diaspora Jew. This is partly by accident and partly by choice. I was born in the U.S. My Jewish grandparents came to Boston from Poland and Germany after the Nazis made them into child refugees. Accident. My mother, raised Catholic, chose Judaism, married my father, and converted. By choice. As for me, I could move to Israel, the promised land, anytime I want. Many people I know have done this, but I don't want to. How can this be? I am a religious person. My prayer book is dripping with longing for this land, full of texts written by people who couldn't get there. The Torah that I study week after week is in large part a chronicle of my people inhabiting that land and then trying to return to it. And even if I prefer to stay in the U.S., how is it that millions of traditional religious Jews are happy to live all over the world when they could easily relocate to their beloved spiritual homeland? Today, that land has descended into hell. The IDF perpetrates mass murder. Hamas insists on acts of war. Prisoners suffer in desperate conditions. Palestinians starve en masse in a Gaza that has become a ghetto. It is more obvious than ever that Jewish statehood in the Holy Land has not ended our spiritual exile. A Jewish state may be a political reality, but it is not a spiritual solution. It cannot satisfy our longing. We yearn for something far, far deeper. We yearn for the repair of the world, the end of falsehood and bloodshed, the reign of peace and justice. I think this deeper yearning, not satisfied by land acquisition, goes way back before the Exodus, back to the late chapters of the book of Bereshit. In this week's Torah portion, Jacob and his children are living happily in Egypt. Before Jacob dies, though, he asks that they bury him in Canaan. So after his death, the Jewish people travel together to the promised land for his burial and funeral. It's not that big a deal. It doesn't take 40 years. They just ask the Pharaoh, he says yes, and they go. And then they come back to their homes in Egypt. These are maybe the first diaspora Jews, and their exile seems voluntary. They could move to Israel, but that's not where they live. That's not where they're raising their children and involved in government and generally thriving. And more, there is a deep purpose, perhaps one they're not even aware of, for their exile in Egypt. Jacob's death ends the period of the patriarchs and matriarchs, the Avot and Imahot. These iconic three generations of ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Rachel and Leah, are credited as the originators of our spiritual tradition. Genesis has been largely a book not so much about a community as about these towering individuals whose personalities and accomplishments still reverberate in our liturgy, our mythology, our souls. And from the beginning, there is this strange pressure for each of these generations to have one single spiritual inheritor, a chosen child, to continue the mission, to receive messages from God, never mind the familial discord this may create. It's Isaac, not Ishmael. It's Jacob, not Esav. And Jacob seems poised to father the next great inheritor. But something changes in Jacob's generation. His plan to marry Rachel goes awry when he is tricked into marrying Leah first, and he eventually also marries two of their servants for a total of four wives, with whom he fathers 13 children. Rachel is the last one to give birth, and her firstborn son Joseph seems early on to be that special chosen one, the one Jacob favors. Joseph, like the three patriarchs, is a singular personality. His individual story is dramatic and righteous. But what he's not is the next Isaac, the next Jacob. There is no next Jacob. A new era has begun. The era of Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel, which is Jacob's alternate name. This becomes the name of the nation, which will be used throughout the Bible and beyond. The dynasty is no longer a dynasty, but an expanded family in which all are equal inheritors of the tradition with no single clear leader. A large group in solidarity and spiritual alignment. Simultaneous with this shift is the movement from Canaan to Egypt. Our parsha is the end of Bereshit and the beginning of Shemot, the second book of the Torah, which will be radically different than the first. Jacob gives his parting blessings to his children at the dawn of the exile and transmits a crucial message. God will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your ancestors. They could return right now. The text makes sure we know they're able, shows us how easy it is. But they don't. Instead, they allow their holy land to exist as a horizon of spiritual possibility. Here, the promised land becomes what it remains for the rest of the five books of Moses, an ever-receding myth, somewhere we approach but never fully reach. And this is how the Jewish people, as we know it, is born. Exile is dangerous, make no mistake. Though Joseph wants his family to live with him in Egypt and share in the power and abundance he has attained there, Jacob needs explicit encouragement from God before going. "Have no fear of descending to Egypt," God told him in last week's Parsha, "for I shall establish you as a great nation there. I myself shall descend with you to Egypt, and I myself will also surely bring you up." Jacob is right to be afraid. In Egypt, his descendants will face mass enslavement and murder. And yet there's something about exile that is necessary to the Jewish mission in the world, that both expands and deepens it. As Joseph tells his brothers when they're first reunited, "Don't be distressed. God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival in the land and to sustain you for a momentous deliverance." Exile is not all bad, the Torah tells us. In fact, it is indispensable. It has a very real purpose. It widens the capacity of the Jewish people. It allows us to grow beyond a closed-off little family that talks to God. It allows our spirituality to impact history. The late 19th century Polish Hasidic thinker known as the Sfat Emet is one of my personal favorite Torah commentators. I doubt my love for his teachings can be separated from my love for my own Polish grandfather, Zichrono Livracha. Living amidst rampant and institutionalized anti-Semitism, the Sfat Emet taught, quote, "This is the purpose of exile, that Israel make visible God's kingdom, which is indeed everywhere. The true meaning of the word galut, exile, is hitgalut, revealing, that the glory of God's kingdom be revealed in every place." End quote. These two Hebrew words share a root for a good reason. Galut, exile, and hitgalut, revealing. Exile is dangerous. One is uncovered, without protection, vulnerable. Showing oneself, speaking truth, can be dangerous in the same way. The faith of the Jewish diaspora is that this kind of vulnerability can be worth it. If you stay in your fortress, you are safe, but you are cut off. You cannot communicate. If you grab your flashlight and walk into a dark, uncertain world, you light up the road on which you walk. The transformation of the patriarch era into an era of communal expansion in Egypt has a similar kind of opening quality, an uncovering that also entails a loss. The patriarchal intimacy with God, a clarity and protection, give way to an imperfect but much more widely shared relationship with God. Jacob himself feels this loss as it happens. His blessing of his 12 sons in this week's parsha begins with a mysterious introduction. "Assemble yourselves," he announces, "and I will tell you what will befall you in the latter days." Be'acharit hayamim. But he never seems to get to that information, nor does he specify what days he means. What follows instead is an oblique poem containing cryptic blessings for his children. An old midrash sheds light. He wanted to reveal the end of the exile, but the Shekhinah, the presence of God, departed him. So he began to speak of other things. This failure to communicate is connected to exile. Far from home under foreign rule, Jacob is in some way blocked from prophecy. A kind of perfect awareness has been lost to him, signaling the end of his era of patriarchal perfection and the beginning of something else, something larger and deeper. When the Sfat Emet, a wise man living in the exile of his own time, tries to teach about this midrash, he too is partly blocked. His memory fails him. He teaches, quote, "I believe my grandfather quoted the rabbi of Peshishcha as wondering why Jacob wanted to reveal the end. His answer was that when the end is known, exile is made easier. That's all I remember. But it seems to mean the same. Revealing the end means knowing there is an end to exile, and that shows it to be but a matter of hiding, not a force of its own. Jacob, our father, just wanted there to be no mistake about this, that it all be obvious. But that goal eluded him. You need to struggle to find truth." End quote. The contemporary spiritual exile, the one you and I are living through, is not easy. At times it is horrific. How it will end, how a better world could be revealed, is not yet clear. But if we are struggling to find the truth, struggling to uncover it, then we will not have wasted our time. Wherever we are in the world, it is our task right here and right now to reveal and enact the good and the holy, the better world that is possible, hiding in plain sight. Chazak chazak, v'nitchazek.